I think in order to fully win, I need to turn that into a karaoke version. Was that what I was required to do?
Yeah, that was actually the...
Yeah, so... Oh, yeah, I gotta strip the lyrics out of that so you can sing along yourself. So my official clock here says it's start time. So I'm Greg Smith. I work as a consultant for Second Quadrant, wind around tuning people's Postgres databases for them all over the place, but mostly the US. This talk is actually an updated version of a more detailed talk that's sitting on Second Quadrant's projects webpage. The earlier talk kind of got very deep into some things that I'm just going to gloss over on this one. So if you find the first part of this talk interesting and go, I wish I had more detail on that, those are available in those earlier slides. Presentation called Just Inside the PostgreSQL Buffer Cache. This one kind of goes a little bit more into how that ends up working out into the rest of the outside world other than just the databases looking at. So if you... I'm sure most people here have set shared underscore buffers, the setting that adjusts how much memory is dedicated to the database that it uses for caching. The way that actually works under the hood, when you create a database and you put a series of tables into it, each of the databases becomes a subdirectory, each of the tables becomes a subdirectory, and each of those directories gets filled with files that are at most 1 gigabyte in size so that you don't run into the normal 32 gigabyte file system limits. Yeah, but you can increase it.
Tables don't get subdirectory.
Yeah, it's all right.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter. So the files, hey, it's been sitting on the web for this many years, nobody noticed yet, so thank you. So underneath the file ends up looking to Postgres as a series of 8 kilobyte blocks, which also will get called pages in some contexts. So everything that's in the buffer cache, you give it a size, and it's internally just a simple array that lists, okay, here's a buffer, you get some number of them, and each of the things that's in there just points to one particular 8K block on disk. And it's all treated as a circular buffer, this buffer cache thing. So it'll start filling in literally at entry 0 on it, and it'll go all the way up to whatever the number you assign for it, and then it'll roll over back to 0 again, and it just keeps sort of going through that circular bit looking at it. Initially, all the buffers in the cache get marked as free, and then as you allocate stuff, they become not free. The way the database works, there's very few situations where they ever become marked as free again. From the context of if you've gone to the trouble of reading stuff into memory, you're not going to get rid of it until you've got something to replace it with that's better. So there's not many things that ever get, say, okay, this is free now because I'm not using it anymore. The assumption is, if you're not using it anymore, you don't just get rid of it, you keep it in cache in case somebody's going to want to use it again. So each of the actual entries in the cache has this thing called a tag. It says what file the entry belongs to. Thank you for that Pac-Man interlude.
So each of the
tags refers to what file is in there, and then there's also a set of flags that are in the buffer cache that tell you what state the thing is in. So you can have something that's pinned. Pinned is a very low-level thing that you normally don't have to worry about. It says that something's being used actively by a process. It's kind of got a lock on it so that no one else will mess with it underneath what that one process is trying to do with it. The more interesting one is each of the pages that's in memory that refers to a block will have a flag on it that says whether or not the thing is dirty, which means that since it's been read in, or if it's a new page, if it's been modified, it gets marked as dirty, so then the system knows at some point it has to circle back to that thing and write it back out again. If you just want simple statistics on is my cache working effectively to look at things, you can get those things by looking at views like pgstat.io user tables. There's a couple of other ones that are floating around. You can get that at the file level. You can get it at the database level. And those are good enough for tuning reads. If you increase shared buffers, those numbers should go up. I mean, that part's pretty simple. The real trick is when you actually start putting systems into the real world, you discover that you need to balance reads versus writes, and the tuning for write capacity and latency against against reads and everything else is where things tend to get a little more complicated. So the way this works is when you've got a client that's running and he needs a block from a file for something, it does what's called a buffer allocation. It says, I need this file, this block, in order to be able to work with the stuff I'm doing. If it's already sitting in the cache, that's great. It updates the stuff saying, okay, I got a cache hit, and then it returns that to you after it increases this number called the usage count. The usage counts start at one when buffers are first set up. Every time someone uses something, the usage count goes up, and every time a buffer gets allocated, if it's not in the cache already, the thing that allocates buffers starts decreasing usage counts off all the things that it finds, and kind of scanning from the top to bottom in the circular fashion, looking for things to what they call evict. So whenever you're allocating one thing, you inevitably are getting rid of something else if it's not already in the cache. And that eviction process is one of those things that it's, there's a variety of implementations that people will do for those. The typical thing that you're always worried about when evicting things that the usage count helps with is the situation where, let's say, you're reading every block from just a huge table. You know, if you implement that badly, which was the case in earlier versions of Postgres, it improved in 8.1 and got a little bit better in 8.3 as well. The problem that would happen is, if you read something that's bigger than you've got physical memory, it'll just chug through that one file and then leave you with a buffer cache full of nothing but that one giant file you just read, which is probably not what you want. So these usage counts end up increasing so that the popular pages that are in memory get usage counts that go up, and that keeps them in memory more often. So the trick is when a usage count for something falls to zero and someone wants to allocate a buffer, that thing is now a candidate for eviction. It could be written by the background writer. If at the point when the client gets to there, if the thing is dirty and the usage count is at zero, the client itself actually writes that thing to disk and waits for it to write to disk before it can then use that buffer for its own purposes. Yep. The circular scanning of the buffer cache, as it's stepping through, basically, every time someone says, allocate me a buffer, it decreases the usage count on wherever the pointer's at, and then it just keeps going through there, decreasing them. So if you had a buffer cache full of fives, for example, the biggest the usage counts get, you could actually have to make five passes through the buffer cache just to find a single buffer to allocate. That doesn't actually happen in practice, but that's what ends up happening if you get the stuff filled with really popular buffers, is it kind of slows down scanning time to allocate new ones. So then after the dirty thing gets written out, then the new block gets read back in again into memory. So I already started on this a little bit. Hey, there you go. That's what we were just talking about. Any page that doesn't have a usage count of zero is safe. It can't be evicted yet until the circular scanning process drops it down. It just won't even be considered. The maximum right now that you can get as usage counts is five. And the that number is kind of pulled out of the air. There hasn't been a lot of research into why is it 5 and not 3 or 10 or something. You know, that number has survived a little bit of scrutiny, but you shouldn't assume that that's kind of, you know, the magically optimized number. And one of the research projects we'd love to have someone do at some point is to get a couple of different type of database workloads and figure out whether there are workloads that benefit from increasing that number to something else. As suggested, the main reason it's not made bigger than that by default, which you'd think is be a good thing because it would keep popular pages in there more often, is this risk that you're going to get a buffer cache filled with nothing but popular pages. And if the thing pulling the usage counts down doesn't execute faster than the things that are increasing them because of popularity, you can end up in a situation where it is locked, unable to allocate new buffers that things need for their working set. So that's the risk of making it really high just because you can. So it's not really well defined what the safe upper limit of that thing is. It's kind of an ongoing research topic. So Postgres is not designed to take over your entire system and you give it memory and it uses that memory and that's the end of it. It's designed to rely on the operating system cache that's underneath of that. Really shared buffers is doing the same thing that the operating system cache is doing, which is finding popular blocks that are in files that you're accessing and keeping the popular ones in cache and keeping the other ones in there. So basically, when you read a new block in, it's going to read it into the operating system's cache, and then it's going to turn around and transfer the thing into the cache of Postgres, process people usually call double buffering. And so it's actually going to be taking up twice as much RAM as it theoretically has to. So there's some research wandering around towards using some low-level file system, things that Cedric, who did a talk yesterday, is working on to possibly improve this whole situation. But at the moment, when you first read something in, it's going to take up twice as much space. And accordingly, you really want the Postgres to not have even a majority of the memory in the system, because if you do something that's really intensive, and let's say Postgres has 60% of the RAM in the system, this double buffering means that you're basically going to wipe out the operating system cache for anything but the database if you run something fast that is filling up Postgres's database. You know, because you'll have the 60% block that Postgres is using, and then just loading that whole 60% is going to just blow away the 40% that was in the rest of the operating system cache, and now you've taken everyone else's cache away from them. So you really don't want to give it too much memory, but you don't really want to give it a tiny amount instead, unless you're on Windows where only a tiny amount really works. For Unix systems that can deal well with large amounts of memory, this usage count thing that Postgres does just works better for some types of database workloads than the operating system cache, which is typically optimized for slightly different purposes. And the exact mix of how much buffer cache versus how much operating system cache is optimal for your application, you know, it's one of those things that varies. You can talk with people that will say, oh, well, everything works better if I put it in the Postgres buffer cache. And you can talk with other people who have just as good of benchmarks that say, oh, the stuff absolutely works better if I make the Postgres buffer cache tiny and put everything in the operating system cache. And they're both right. It's workload dependent. And I'll show you a couple of different workloads and how it is that both things can be true at once depending on what you're doing. It's possible to look at what's in the operating system cache kind of as a bigger view onto the entirety of the caching in the database. There's a Postgres extension called pgfncore that does that. Cedric presented something on that yesterday. That's interesting if you do want to get that data and kind of get a larger view of what's going on. It's interesting data to supplement into things. My personal feeling on it is that most of the time when I go and look at that data as opposed to what's in the buffer cache, it's kind of the same sort of data, just more so. So if you look at what's in the buffer cache and you extrapolate, well, the operating system cache is probably like that but bigger, that hasn't been too bad of an assumption when I've looked at this stuff in the past. There certainly are certain types of workloads where what's in the operating system cache and what's in Postgres's cache are much more divergent, but I think for a common typical system, look at what's in the smaller buffer cache, which you can do easily from the database, and just assume that you're getting a representative snapshot of one third of something that the other two thirds of it look about the same. So how do you actually look at the buffer cache? There's a contrib module that you may or may not have installed, depending on whether you've installed all the contrib modules. If you're going from source code, this little bit at the bottom shows you how to build that thing. It wasn't really all that useful until Postgres 8.3, which is where I added exposing the usage count information to the view. So 8.3, basically the rest of the stats I'm going to talk about here are all things that really got added in 8.3 to improve visibility in this specific area. So if you're running something older, they're not really going to be available to you. The interesting thing to note is that this does install in a database, and when you're looking at stuff that comes out of the view, you're only going to see information related to the database that you've got. Even though the shared buffers cache is shared among all the databases in the system, you can only get the table information for the database that you're connected to. So there'll be blocks there. You can see numbers for them that refer to files, but you don't have access to the catalog information that lets you decode that and actually do anything useful with it. So anytime you're looking at this, you're not necessarily going to get a complete view that you're going to be able to decode at the table level, but you can look at all the gross statistics anyway for the whole thing, and that's all I'm really going to focus on much here. So that stuff I was just talking about. The other thing to be aware of is that when you look at something with PG buffer cache, it's really intensive. It grabs a lot of giant locks on things in not a way that was ever designed to be efficient. This is not something that you want to run all the time. It's something that you might capture a snapshot of once a day or something like that while you're retuning your system. It's not something you want to pop into cron and look at every minute or something like that. Something that captures it periodically, a couple times a day, maybe capture it during peak hours once, capture it during during off hours as well, compare the two, it might be interesting data. The kind of Murphy's Law on this is that the times when you'd most like to get this information at a really fine level is when your system is really busy and there's a lot of stuff going on, which is, of course, the absolute worst time to try to capture the data because it's going to block all that activity while you're going through and capturing it. So. Because it grabs all these locks, if you're actually going to try to do anything with this data, massage it and whatnot, what you might want to do is create a temporary table or some other thing like that, copy the stuff out of the PG buffer cache view into that, and then operate off of that copy rather than the original, because that'll just cut down on kind of the window for how long you're holding these giant locks to look at this stuff. So here's the query that's in the README for PG buffer cache. This is kind of where most of the complicated stuff ends up looking like. So you're just grouping this by rel name, which is the name of the relation, which is usually a table. It can be an index as well. That's involved in there, and then you decode that by looking at the PG class catalog, and that's the part that when you're connecting to a database, you can only see entries in PG class that are relevant for the database you're connecting to, not for other databases, and that's why this thing will only end up giving you useful data about those things. This one just shows you the tables that are using the top, like the 10 tables that have the most of cache allocated to them. So here's a couple. These are data that came out of running PGBench as a simple way to generate some data from a couple of revs back. So this is another report, and all of these little reports I'm showing here will be in, they're in the attachment that's already over on the older version of this talk. There's a file there with, you know, little shell scripts that do all this stuff that you can look at as far as how to compute this stuff. So this actually does a slightly more interesting spin on that, which is to say, well, let's actually look at how big that buffer amount is in megabytes and what percentage of the table is in memory, which is often the number that you're interested in. You know, whether or not it's 100 megabytes or 300 megabytes isn't that useful to you, but if you know, wow, I have 93% of the account's primary key cached and 25% of the account's key cached, that's data that's actually useful to you. You can stare at that and go, oh, okay, well, it's doing what I would hope to do, which is prioritizing loading in the information that I need to do indexed lookup queries on the primary key over actually holding the data for the individual tables. So that's kind of good behavior. This bottom part here will show you what the usage count looked like for that particular, when this is kind of a common usage count thing. If you run PGBench for a bit, this is what you'll see. And these things that have a usage count of 3, 4, and 5 here, those are more commonly those index blocks. Popular index blocks tend to get high usage counts and stay there if you've got stuff that's running a bunch. In this case, there wasn't actually anything running that was dirtying blocks while this was going on, but the later examples will have some more interesting stuff there. So how do people size shared buffers? Well, there's a lot of anecdotal and even some academic tests that suggest, other than Windows, where you want to be under 512 megabytes on Unix systems that do well with shared memory, 15 to 40% is what most people end up settling into as, okay, this seems to work well. The normal sort of anecdotal recommendation is start at 25%. If it looks too small, increase. If it looks like maybe you're not using it effectively, maybe you might decrease, and making that call about whether using it effectively or not is kind of what the second half of this is going to go into. One of the problems with just, in addition to the double, yeah, Bruce?
I'm sorry. That 25% is probably right and a little higher than historically what we recommended. Are we documenting that anywhere? Is that in Robert Hodges' patch? Or?
I don't know that we're actually giving tuning advice in the documentation at this point on this sort of thing. I don't know what the patch. Yeah, but I don't know that there's a numeric number that was associated with that. I think it was
It says, if you have a dedicated database server with 1 gig or more of RAM, a reasonable starting value for shared buffers is 25% of the memory.
All right. Thank you. So there we go. So we've actually put this guideline in there, and you know, this has survived enough investigation that it works well enough to get started. The main downside, in addition to this double buffering problem that keeps you from going too crazy, is checkpoints. What happens, checkpoints are a reconciliation process that happens periodically, every 5 minutes by default is when you'll normally see them, where all of the stuff that's in memory that has been dirty gets guaranteed to be flushed out so that it's all on disk and then the system can kind of move forward what it has to more actively track in terms of being able to recover from a crash. If you've got a large buffer cache, it is quite easy to get that into a situation where that checkpoint can end up being several seconds long at the end, and the system can end up easily hung to where a query will just sit there and not return back for some period of time. So one of the common things that we recommend people do is if there's spots where the system seems to have this kind of stop and go kind of feel to it, if you log your queries and how long the query durations take, by turning on some of the log statement type stuff, and you notice that, and you also turn on logging for checkpoints, and you notice that the really slow queries that pop up periodically all line up with the checkpoints, you probably have one of these checkpoint I/O spike problems. In 8.3 and above, there's a good solution that is resolved. You know, the typical really bad problems that people used to run into There's this spread checkpoints that are controlled by this thing called checkpoint completion target. If you're running on 8.2 or earlier, you really have no choice but to just not give shared buffers that much money or that much RAM to work with. That much, yeah. I'm still thinking about poker, I think. Because the thing to realize is that if you've given memory to the buffer cache, that then is memory that's involved in the checkpointing. The upper bound on how much does a checkpoint do is always how big shared buffers is. So as shared buffers goes up, you become more and more likely to run into the situation where you can just dirty a gigantic amount of RAM, and then the checkpoint has to go sort through all of that. If you make the thing smaller, then the operating system cache, which doesn't have that property, is going to be used instead. Yep.
Do you find this large buffer checkpoint issue is still a problem in 8.3?
Or it's absolutely still a problem if you're not careful about the settings, and that's part of why this later stuff here goes about how you can actually look at the trade-offs that you're making when you play with this thing, because I still see client systems that are tuned quite aggressively, and there's still spots where they run into something where there'll be a second or two pause, and it's really hard to get rid of them under all circumstances, and I do think we're eventually going to have to restart up some of the more advanced techniques we talked about for 8.3, but it was such a huge improvement over beforehand that it was like, wow, this is so big, let's just go with this and not get any fancier for now. I think we may be approaching the point where this needs to get fancier again. Right, it's theoretically possible to crank up the background writer to help with this problem too. Whether or not that's effective depends on the usage count profile of the system, and I'll circle back to that specific topic in a minute then. So how do you actually look at this on a large scale? There's a view that was added to 8.3, again, which is where kind of all this tuning on these problems in this area got really overhauled. There's this thing called PGStat, BGWriter, that gives you statistics about stuff that move in and out of the buffer cache. One of the simplest bits of data is this buffer allocation number. That's kind of like an effective read speed for the entire database. If you look at it, that's how many buffers need to get allocated for something. Maybe they come out of the cache, maybe they don't. That number doesn't reflect that. This is just kind of, it's an interesting number to stare at if you convert it into useful units like megabytes per second to say just how many buffers are getting allocated, because it gives you an idea how much memory churn is happening. You can also look at checkpoints happen two ways. They can happen based on time, which is every 5 minutes by default, or when they just run out of a certain fixed resource that you can tune for checkpoint segments. When it's reached that, it'll make a checkpoint that becomes required rather than a timed one. The ratio of those two can give you an idea whether you've set checkpoint segments usefully. Your goal should be to make most of the checkpoints timed rather than required, because the required ones tend to be a little bit more intensive and more likely to have I/O spike problems. So, if you think about it, there's actually three ways that a buffer can get written out of the cache. It can be written by the checkpoint process, doing its reconciliation for crash recovery. It can be written because a client backend was trying to allocate something and it had to write a dirty buffer because the thing it was handed with a usage count of zero happened to be dirty. Or the background writer, what it does is it kind of wanders ahead of clients doing allocation, tries to find buffers that are dirty that it thinks are the ones the clients are going to be allocated or given for allocation shortly, and it writes those things out instead. You can tell if the background writer is kind of overloaded and not even keeping up with traffic, because this other counter that's in there, this max written clean number, will end up popping up. So the thing to recognize here is that the most efficient of these is the checkpoint. you might think, well, I don't want stuff to happen at checkpoint time. I want it to happen before then. But if you write something before a checkpoint and then you dirty it again, you're going to write it again. And that's the least efficient scenario in this whole thing. So if you write something at checkpoint time, that and you only write it at checkpoint time, that represents the most effective tuning of the database, because now you're guaranteeing, okay, if this thing only gets written at checkpoint time, I'm only writing a copy of it at most every 5 minutes. So the normal tuning exercise here that I'm going to describe how you can collect data for is to optimize for checkpoint writes instead of the other ones. And then the worst of these is when you've got a back-end write, because now you've got a client who's actually stuck with potentially a very long wait to allocate a buffer simply because it didn't have a clean one that it worked on. So general tuning practice is more checkpoint writes. If you can't get it at checkpoint time, get it out by the background writer cleaner, and the thing you absolutely want to minimize are the client back-end ones. So what can you derive from this data? Well, the trick is, if you just have a single snapshot of this, what I just described is all you can really do with it. But if you actually capture two snapshots that have timestamps on them, typically an hour apart is enough to get a decent idea what's going on. Ideally, you'll get a day or two apart, and you capture them. Even with the raw data, you can compute the percent of the buffers that are written by each of these processes, the checkpoints, the background writer, cleaner, and the backends. But if you have the snapshots and you have the counsel and the whole thing, you look at the difference, you can compute a lot of other interesting things. You can compute average minutes between checkpoints. It'll probably be 5. If it's not 5 or more, that represents a problem. You can compute how much is written on average at a checkpoint. It's a very interesting number because the size of these I/O spikes that you'll run into are almost exactly proportional to how big that number is. You can compute how many buffer allocations are happening in megabytes per second. If you look at the buffer allocations per second number, you multiply that by the buffer size and compute the interval. It's probably something a little redundant in that math, but you'll see it in the spreadsheet. You can take that buffer allocations number, which is just a number, it doesn't mean anything, attach two time intervals to it. Suddenly, it's something you can convert into megabytes per second. That's kind of how much memory is actually getting used by this system. The other really interesting number to compute, you can take the three sources for writes on the system, the checkpoint writes, the backend writes, and the background writer cleaner, or the backend writes and the background writer cleaner writes. If you add those up, and again you turn that into megabytes per second, that's a really interesting number too, because that's a number that is essentially what the write rate in between the shared buffers cache and the operating system cache is. And it's kind of interesting from a monitoring perspective to compare what that number is relative to actual I/O on the device. That ratio kind of gives you some information about what the write cache on the operating system is doing for you. So, how do we look at this? I tried to put this into slide format. It failed miserably. So we're going to wander over to a spreadsheet, which will be available in the conference site in OpenOffice and XLS format, so you should be able to work with it. So this here is a pretty big system with 10 gigabytes of shared buffers, 96 gigabytes of RAM total. 10 gigabytes is recognized as about the upper limit on how much you can give to shared buffers before just managing the overhead of shared buffers itself kind of starts to wear the database down because of just general issues that in the design that did not anticipate shared buffers ever getting quite this big is where we're at now. So the idea is this thing right here is two snapshots of pgstat bg writer, all of these values in here that we were just talking about, with timestamps on them. And then if you put timestamps on them, you can now figure out by doing a little math how many seconds elapsed in between those two. You can then take the differences between all these figures. So this is how many buffers I allocated. This is how many I wrote from the back end during those number of seconds. Divide those, compensate for the block size, and multiply those out. And now you start getting the interesting derived figures that come out of this. Let me shrink this a little bit so it's a little easier to read here now that I've gone over. The detailed stuff is really not all that interesting once you've gotten the rest of it. So, there we go. So this, our first number we look at is how many percent, what percent of the checkpoints are timed. They're 100% on the system. That's good. How many minutes are there on average between them? Well, 5 minutes between them because they're all timed. Great. That's kind of what you'd expect on the whole thing. Yes, and this is the good part. So, and then we can stare at what percentage of them were written at checkpoint time. Well, this 90%, that's great. That means that most of the stuff on the system is only getting written once per checkpoint cycle, which is as efficient as you can get things. Almost nothing on a statistical basis is being written by the background writer on this thing. It's doing something, but there's just not very much work for it to do. The buffer's written, there's a little bit written by the backends and the other stuff. So the interesting drive numbers here are... we're actually allocating what turns out to be a rounding error down to zero buffers per second out of this thing, and the flow out of the buffer cache is 1.2 megabytes per second on average, and the checkpoints are writing on average 335 megabytes each. So what ends up happening when you go to tune with this data is as you play around with checkpoint segments and you play around with the size of shared buffers, those numbers, the average write rate and the amount of the size of the average checkpoint, those are going to change around as you make shared buffers larger and you make the time in between checkpoints larger, those numbers go up, and when those get big, that's when checkpoint spikes tend to happen. Sure.
So there's a row there that says buffers clean.
Mm-hmm.
And in the computed over units, it says 0%.
Yeah, that's just because relative to how big the other numbers are, it doesn't show up in one decimal place. Like.
What's that being taken as a percentage?
See. That's as a percentage of the three different ways that you can write buffers out. So in this case, it's 90.4% of them are written by checkpoints, you know, 0.004% are written by that, and then 9.6 are there. There might be a rounding error in that thing too. I'll have to, is that one off? Because it doesn't, no, it adds up to 100. Yeah. So it's 90.4% from checkpoint, 9.6% by backends, and then what essentially turns into zero by the time you round it on any reasonable scale are actually being written by the cleaner. So just doing this, yep, Bruce?
I guess I don't understand. I assume that the backends would only write when they had to and couldn't find another buffer to use. So I always assumed that would be lower than the background writer. That the background writer, if we had a 10% case where the backend's writing, we would see more background writer activity.
Right. Well, the trick is the background writer thing is it's not running really aggressively all the time anymore, because we figured out in the A3 development cycle that if you just let it run, that it's like going all out trying to do stuff, that it just tends to add more overhead and you don't really get much out of it. So if the system's been idle for a while and there's a spike in activity, there's a little bit of lag between when the background writer really kind of keeps up with the load, and those tend to produce a little bit more of these backend writes. So this, you know, a backend write is not terrible. It's just if backend writes are 90% of them, you've probably got something that's tuned wrong. So this system here is someone who shared some of their production statistics and let me use them in this talk. What's interesting is we look at this, and this is a system that looks like it's tuned pretty well. in that we're getting reasonable numbers for all these averages. So you might ask, well, what is the usage count information look like on this thing? And so we have that down here, and this actually shows us why it is that this system is running so well here, which is that 57% of the stuff in this buffer cache, this giant 10 gigabyte buffer cache, is hitting a usage count of 5, you know, kind of bumping into the limit of the whole thing. And generally my line is anything that's 3 or above is a popular buffer. And so 80% of the buffers that are in this thing are popular. So the reason why this database is working so well and everything's getting written at checkpoint time and no other time is that all of the popular buffers are getting into RAM, they're getting high usage counts, and they're staying there. And they get written out once per checkpoint cycle, and that's as often as they need to get written out. So in this system, it's real easy to bias a system like this where you're getting lots of high usage counts to write the stuff at checkpoint time and to not have that many sources for other writes. And it also tells us that attempts to get the background writer to do more are kind of doomed to failure because the background writer can't write things until their usage count falls to 0. So things that have a usage count of 1 and 0 are the only things that are even considered as candidates. And on this system, even with this giant buffer cache, there's only about 6% of, or 5% of the stuff in the buffer cache that ever gets below 2. So the background writer is kind of doomed here. It can't really do anything with this data because the usage counts are all so high on the majority of the stuff that's in the cache that there's just nothing for it to do that isn't going to take away from some other thing that's running. Well, because if that's kind of the design, the trade-off in the design says, if it's been used recently, you probably don't want to write that one out. You want to prefer to write something that hasn't been used recently. That's kind of the fundamental of the design.
Is that the difference between it's being read frequently and it's being altered frequently? So if you've got a buffer which has been altered just once, mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you want to keep it in the cache in either case. It's just the idea is if you're reading it a lot, we're going to assume that maybe you might be updating it a lot as well. And that's a simplification, and maybe it'd be nice if we had read usage counts versus write ones. But, you know, this scheme of just saying anytime you touch it, it's a popular buffer, prefer not to write it out if it gets dirty, like that simplification is enough that for a system that works like this one, this whole scheme is effective. And so this system is an example of one that is using shared buffers effectively. And the reason that this thing has shared buffers at 10 gigabytes, which is kind of the upper end of the effective range, is because it was using them so effectively. Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, the reason you write out a dirty buffer is so that you get evicted quickly. But obviously, if it has a high usage count, evicting it doesn't do us anything, so let's just wait for the checkpoint. I think that's really the reason we never went down that road.
But if you're evicting everything,
that's exactly it. The kind of the big theme here is the checkpoint is the most efficient way to write something, but if you push all of the writes to checkpoint time, the checkpoint's going to get bigger and bigger, and eventually that'll cause I/O spikes. So if you produce these computed numbers for average size and look at percentage written by checkpoints, this lets you directly measure that trade-off as you make it. As you adjust shared buffers, as you adjust checkpoint segments, you actually stare at this and get numbers that go, okay, I retune this thing, now I'm getting 80% of the buffers written at checkpoint time instead of 50%, that's great. oh wait, but my average checkpoint write went from 200 megabytes to 500 megabytes and now I'm getting spikes. Like, that ends up being the kind of trade-offs that you have to do in computing these statistics, which I don't think anyone really analyzes these in the way that I've been doing it recently. It makes it really obvious what you've changed when you make a change in the parameters. Yeah, you always want to leave the writes in the checkpoints if you can, because those are efficient. It's just if you go too far on that, you'll end up with these checkpoint spikes that you have to that will cause their own problems. So that's basically the trade-off, and I think everyone who works in this area has been fighting this trade-off since, you know, back in 8.1.8.2, there wasn't really anything you could do about it. Now it's better, and we have parameters that you can tune for them. And this technique of taking this data, dropping them into this spreadsheet, collecting up the usage count stuff, lets you see whether or not that's working and directly measure the tunable stuff. So let me show you another system as well. So this is a system that is really getting benefit from shared buffers. When you see usage counts going up to 5 and you see a large percentage of them like that, those are buffers that Postgres tends to do a better job at dealing with than the operating system cache. So second system here is one that's not quite as effective as what we were just looking at. So here's a guy where still almost all the checkpoints are timed. There's 5 minutes between them. And now only 4.6% of the buffers on this thing are getting written by at checkpoint time. But a giant 54% of them are actually written by the background writer. So on this workload, the background writer is actually really earning its keep. It's getting work done for us that's useful. So there's not all that much activity, but this thing is actually allocating 20 megabytes per second of new buffers that are going through that in RAM. You know, again, that's not 20 megabytes per second of disk read because they might come from the operating system cache, but it gives you an idea that this system has got a lot more memory churn than this one up here where that number was 0. Basically the other one had this giant cache, everything fit in it, and it didn't really have to do all that much with it. This system is obviously struggling a lot more to keep up with things and hold it all in RAM. And then the actual writes on this thing, the average checkpoint is only 5.1 megabytes, or the average checkpoint write. So, and that goes back to the fact that the checkpoint process is only writing 4.6% of the buffers in this whole mess. So for some reason, this system just doesn't really seem to be benefiting from trying to push stuff towards checkpoints. And then if we go look at its usage count data, the reason why that is becomes really obvious. So this has got a completely different kind of usage count profile than the other system. If you consider 3 and above popular buffers, whereas in the other system, 80% of the buffers in the cache were 3 or above. In this one, it's only 20%. So this system right here is one where shared buffers is really not delivering much value above and beyond what the operating system cache would do. Things are not getting high usage counts typically and staying in RAM as a result of those. Instead, there's a heavy churn of data moving in and out of the buffer cache for things that are going back to the operating system cache that it's relying on heavily. So you can see that from the gross figures in the PGStat BG writer, and then when you actually look at the usage count data, it kind of makes sense as to why you're seeing that in the gross statistics. It just is this workload's very different as far as what can and can get cached. Yep.
So in this case, are we seeing someone whose working set is vastly larger than their shared buffers?
Right. In the other guy, his working set basically fit in shared buffers, and it was running against it, and there was very little interaction between it and the operating system cache. This thing is shuffling stuff heavily back and forth, and luckily the background writer is offloading a good percentage of that.
So it seems like for this guy, there's two things you could do. One is you could make shared buffers smaller, so as to free up more memory on the system for other things.
Right.
And the other thing is you could vastly
Right, but if you do the latter, you increase the possibility that you might have checkpoint problems and other stuff like that. But the kind of the point of...
What advice would you give this guy? I guess what I'm asking.
The advice I would give is look at whether the disks are overutilized or not right now. Tune in one direction or the other and see what direction the application level metrics for performance move in when you do that. And this gives you a way to actually quantify what happened to explain those changes. You know, all this stuff, the best you really can do with it, there's no way to stare at this data and go definitively, oh, you would benefit from bigger or smaller. I mean, I had a client I was working with recently, who's a system that's much busier than all this other stuff, and I retuned everything to make more happen at checkpoint time, and we spread checkpoints out, and we did all this other stuff, and it was a disaster. Like, the application just did not like having that stuff spread out over a longer period of time. It liked basically get in, dump all the checkpoint stuff out in one batch, and I think it was one of those where just doing it more like that turned it into sequential I/O, and by trying to spread the checkpoint out more and get more in each checkpoint, it just increased the amount of random I/O instead, and that ended up being a problem for that system. So it's really tricky to look at this just from this perspective and know definitively what you're supposed to do. This at least lets you measure what you're touching and what's moving around underneath you when you adjust this stuff. My third system, and again, these spreadsheets are all going to be attached to the presentation. This is kind of the least effective of them all on this whole thing. We're getting a little bit more written at checkpoint time, but if we look at the buffer cache statistics on this whole thing, you know, we're only getting 34% of them are even hitting 2 on this system. I mean, this is one that is just not really benefiting from the usage count logic in the database at all. And so this is a guy where you'd almost certainly be fine with reducing shared buffers because they aren't getting, if they're not getting high usage counts, putting more in the buffer cache is probably not going to make some things suddenly become more popular. You'll just be able to cache more of these things that are only ever going to get a usage count of 0 and 1. That's a good question. Well, but the process, the churn on the whole thing doesn't, it will clean it and make it not dirty. So you notice all of the things that are zero are not dirty at the moment. So typically these are things that for various reasons it passed over and it might have written them out, it might have decreased the usage count, but it just didn't give them to somebody else yet. This is kind of unusual. You don't normally see that many of them that ever hit a usage count of 0 on this whole thing, but like the workload on this system is very kind of strange. Like one situation is you could end up with... well, I'm not going to go into that because I'm starting to run out of time here anyway. So the idea here is if you have this actually shows the situation for this guy as well on a gross scale, which is that he's got 20% of his cache that's dirty at any time and is still ends up needing to write 30 megabytes of that at a time each checkpoint. So I mean those ratios are kind of interesting ones to stare at as well. So the spreadsheet's available online. I guarantee you that if you take a PGStat BG writer of your system, wait a day, take another one, dump them into this spreadsheet, you'll learn interesting things about the flow of stuff in and out of your system that you might not have thought of before. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if we wanted to increase the thing, we could slice and dice the usage count dropping thing, and that would probably be an improved implementation that would get rid of the worst case scenario a bit. So, Yeah. So we'll probably have to do something like that before going to really exorbitantly high values on the whole thing. So, again, using the operating system is not terrible. It's the operating system caches. They get lots of optimizations themselves. It works fine. And giving the stuff to the operating system, taking it out of checkpoints, that's sometimes what you want to do. So you shouldn't assume it's automatically the right thing to give the memory to the database anyway and to try to keep it in memory. And what I'd hope is that by seeing examples of these two here, this first guy, this is a profile of something that benefits from shared buffers, and you can see that in these statistics, and you can see it in the usage count statistics versus these other ones. My hope would be that if you gather information on your own server, you can then look at those statistics and see which of these is more like and get a better idea what you might end up doing with tuning on your system, and it gives you very concrete numbers to play with when you do that tuning to measure its effectiveness. I think I've already gone over all of that stuff. So, database buffer cache, you can instrument. You do have to save regular usage snapshots to do anything useful with it. You measure the trade-offs, and as you can see, the workloads on this thing are very, very different. So someone who goes, well, I did this with the background writer, it worked great for me, you can do that same thing to someone else, and it'll fail miserably because they have a different usage count profile. Only things that are skewed towards having most of the buffers have low usage count numbers benefit from the background writer. Only things that have lots of buffers with high usage counts benefit towards trying to get them written at checkpoint time. But, that's got downsides and dangerous bits as well. Big thank you to Kevin Grittner from the Wisconsin Quartz and Ben Chobot from Silent Media. They anonymously provided me with the system data that you've just seen in order to get three moderately large production systems and have me be able to show snapshots. The somewhat unfortunate nature of this business is I have a couple of them that are much, much cooler than that, but of course they're all covered under NDA, so I can't tell you anything about any of them. But these systems are really good because they look like slightly scaled down versions of the two most common workloads that I end up seeing. On faster servers, just the numbers get bigger as you've got bigger and bigger hardware. So that's it for me, and if you want to talk about all this stuff, the PGSQL performance list is where all the people that like to debate about this stuff hang out at and have lots of fun discussions on things. Yeah, Bruce?
First, I apologize for asking so many questions, but with checkpoint segments, which indicates how many wall files we use, we were able to easily say you checkpoint too frequently, then clearly you should be increasing checkpoint segments, and we have a little wall warning. I know you indicated that you don't feel there's any real way of sort of giving people an idea of whether they should make it bigger, smaller, like on the fly. But have you given any thought to how that might be done in the future?
Well, that's why I'm still collecting all this data. Every time I do one of these for a personal system or a customer, I get a little bit more data that I can actually model how would that work for some of these people. So what I'm starting to see now that I can measure this stuff is you change checkpoint segments, you make it 10 times as big, that does things that are very difficult to predict in advance as far as how that's actually going to impact the load on the whole thing and how it's going to spread it out. And as I was saying, I've even had ones where I've tuned them towards theoretical better performance, and just because they changed the ratio of sequential to random write on the system, it actually made performance worse, which you never would have expected from the model. But at least by having the model, I was able to measure exactly what I changed and go, okay, this was positive numerically, but it didn't actually work on the application. So further moving in that direction is clearly wrong. Maybe I might even try an alternate tuning where I go against normal accepted practice if this system seems to be one that doesn't really follow the normal kind of standard behavior anyway. So, but at least at all times I was doing this in a very controlled environment and not just a, well, let's change this number and see what happens sort of way. So I found this really effective for actually measuring the changes. And the other thing is, and I don't think I really stressed this enough in this talk, and I meant to, what will end up happening with a lot of these things is you'll make a change to something, you know, and performance will improve, and it'll improve, and improve, and then it'll kind of flatline. That's normally when you know you're done. When you're doing this as an iterative process, you don't want to change it a huge amount in any one increment. You know, you move it up a bit, you measure how it goes. Once those changes start to level off, you might even back off a little bit and say, okay, I'm going to draw the line here as the spot where this stopped improving. You know, that's kind of the way when you know you're finished with this sort of tuning exercise is you try tuning two values and you go, well, I can barely tell the difference between those two things. That's when an iterative process, making gradual changes and making sure you're going in the right direction has definitely finished. I haven't really noticed that much of a, you know, local minimum maximum kind of thing in there. It's usually pretty obvious you're moving in the right direction, you're moving in the wrong direction, or you're stable and you're not really changing anything. Like the idea that, I mean, there are some things if you've got like ridiculously small settings for shared buffers, you can't even use this data usefully. Like if you've got the default 32 megabytes, there's not enough in shared buffers where tracking what's in there is going to be interesting. Nothing's ever going to get a high usage count before it gets evicted because it's constantly churning through this tiny little space it needs. So you really do, if you've got a server at the default settings, you may discover that this data, all that it shows you is that there's heavy, heavy churn in the buffer cache and you can't really tell much about it. Other than that, you increase the number, you're going to get a whole different kind of profile altogether, and you can't really predict what that's going to look like in advance. You just have to measure it and then take a step forward and see what you notice. Yep.
So you recommend timings of like 24 hours to run this. Do you, in your experience, do you see big differences if you change the time difference between the two snapshots from like hourly to daily or
whatever? I mean, systems have... If I get one of these that I'm collecting at an hourly basis, you'll see just more spikiness in the data where, you know, you'll have hot times of days where the buffer allocations number goes up and the reads and writes can go up. But I mean, in general, I just go for something that's averaging over a couple of days because the hour-to-hour variations are not that interesting. And it's really easy to get overwhelmed in the data and try to hyper-optimize stuff at a really low level rather than kind of taking a big-picture perspective. So once a day seems to be good enough. If I can get statistics over 2 or 3 days, that's even better. You know, ones that are... Some people might even want to tune over a week just so that they make sure they've got all the ebb and flow in the weekly workflow or whatnot. But that seems to be the useful sort of range. When I collect hourly data, I just tend to get overwhelmed with it, and I haven't really been able to find much incremental value in looking at it at that low of a resolution. But it's possible. Just looking at it at all is kind of the big step forward. Oh, and Magnus is actually the person who actually built PGStat Background Writer for us after I went, this is the stuff I want to look at, but I don't actually know how to instrument the whole thing. So we're kind of design and implementation on that particular feature, and it's interesting that that's been in there since 8.3, and I don't think anyone's ever described what to actually do with the data since then. So so we'll see how it goes in there. All right, so I think that's it. We'll start getting ready. I'm out of time here.